From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. The first Iraqi students to be part of the Iraq Education Initiative at the University of Iowa have arrived on campus. In the first half hour, we'll talk about the goals of the program with Scott King, Assistant Dean of International Programs at the UI. Then in our second half hour, we'll talk with Pakistani college students in Iowa about their country's devastating floods. Pakistan's worst floods in eight decades have claimed over 1,600 lives and affected more than 20 million people. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. With U.S. troop levels decreasing in Iraq and now below 50,000 for the first time since the U.S. invasion, we've been hearing a lot about how Iraqis are having to step up to take more responsibility for stabilizing and running their country. And there's a small part of that effort happening now right here in Iowa. The Iraqi government has allocated $55 million for the first year of what is called the Iraq Education Initiative. Around 600 Iraqi students are being enrolled at universities in the United States and Britain so these men and women can return to Iraq and contribute to their country's resurgence. The first Iraqi students to be part of the Iraq Education Initiative at the University of Iowa have arrived on campus. Joining us now to discuss the initiative and these new arrivals, Scott King, Assistant Dean of International Programs at the University of Iowa from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Welcome to you, Assistant Dean King.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back talking with you about this again.
Yes, we did talk back in 2009 about this, and when we spoke in the summer of 2009, we were led to believe that it would be only a matter of months before the Iraqi students would be at the University of Iowa. Obviously a delay. What caused that delay?
Well, I think they were very ambitious in not being aware of the complexity of how this program was going to be set up. Initially, I think there were plans that it would be partially administered outside of Iraq itself. That changed, so it was entirely administered within the country. So setting up the infrastructure, communications, setting up even the plan on how to recruit, evaluate, and award scholarships was a lot more complex than originally thought. But what I like is that throughout all this, the emphasis was on doing it correctly. Mm-hmm. Doing it fast was not the priority on that. So they were very careful to adhere to the goals of the program, the ideals, and yes, it took an additional year to get here, but the first students are here and we're very excited about it.
I alluded to the goal of this initiative. Elaborate on that, the facets of this type of student exchange.
Yeah. Well, I think many people are aware that with all the wars, going back even to the Iran-Iraq war of a couple of decades ago, a lot of the middle class, a lot of the educated class of Iraq had fled the country, and there's a dearth of everybody from physicians through engineers, you know, trained bureau administrators and that. And one of the goals of this program is to educate what will become the middle class of Iraq and bring people back with skills so they can rebuild the society as they go along physically rebuilding the country.
Mm-hmm. Tell us now, this is the initial wave in the U.S. How many Iraqi students have arrived in the U.S. and how many here at the University of Iowa?
Yeah. Well, they're having about 80 arrive this month is what I understand. And if airplane flights are on time, we actually have four that have already arrived. One woman was supposed to arrive at 11 o'clock this morning, so I hope she's on her way to Iowa City. We know of one other student who's arriving later today, and then we have three that are in various phases of the visa process, the permission to leave, that we still hope get here within the next week or so.
And you've met some of them?
I've met the two that have arrived already.
So what are they like? Tell us about them. Who are they?
Okay, well, two very engaging young men. Adnan is a math major who is coming from Nasiriyah, and also Diyar is a geosciences major from Erbil, one of part of the Kurdish region. They are engaging young men, very excited to be here. In spite of probably 4 or 5 days of jet lag, they still have twinkles in their eyes, excitement on that. Also, very, very proud to be representatives of this program and of their country. I can see through them that they had a very, I guess, I don't want to say challenging selection process. And those that came out of it have felt, how do I want to say this? You know, are very proud of being selected and feel very empowered to come here and do their best.
How are they selected? Is it the Iraqi government? Mm-hmm. The Iraqi government pays for this program in full. The Iraqi government also selects them?
Yeah, there's a commission they set up. And this whole program has been kept as much out of the political arena as possible. So an independent commission that, first of all, selected students based upon standard test scores, grades in their secondary, post-secondary work. And then they were interviewed individually to determine the final ones that were selected. One thing that has made this unique and actually one of the challenges, the government was committed to diversity in the program from the very beginning. So they have allocated the scholarships by province. Population of a province is 10% of the country. They get 10% of the scholarships. Mm. So that has been one of the challenges in some of the more rural provinces. But it's allowing a diversity of students from ethnic backgrounds, religious backgrounds, just not open to the people who happen to have the access to the big cities like Baghdad.
So it's more than that. So they're reaching out to the – what about the diversity in terms of male-female?
Well, the executive director keeps emphasizing there is no gender restrictions on it. And this first group is about 25% female. I think it's a little lower than they wished. But yet, considering the part of the world, the problems with some of the smaller, more rural areas, I think 25% is a pretty good accomplishment.
Thinking back to our 2009 conversation at the advent of this, some really large numbers talking, estimated 10,000 students per year in the United States and other English-speaking nations for 5 years, some 50,000 students over 5 years. Where are we at? We're right at the thin end of the wedge of that.
Yeah, we're very – there. Let's say about 80 students are coming.
In the entire United States, four of them, five of them?
In this month, 80 students. So we're getting 5 to 8 of them, depending on visas. So we've done fairly well.
The spigot has just opened.
It has just opened, yes.
Tell us about some of the things – I'm interested in the people that – the two young men who are here too. Their first impressions, have you gleaned anything from them about what excites them about being in Iowa? Of course, their studies, but being here.
Oh, I think above all is the studies. And I actually heard from one of the departments today whose comment was, boy, do we have a catch. So I'm glad it's working both ways on that. But I think they're also very interested in learning about American ways, about Iowa ways, meeting other students. We had a reporter from the Daily Iowan who came and talked to them the other day, and they sat there for more than an hour just talking about their experience. And these are students who had arrived less than 48 hours earlier, you know, even with they're doing pretty well with the spoken English.
Right. And the obvious question that many of our listeners must have on their minds is we'd love to meet them on the air right now. In fact, we do have plans in some time. They will go through some intensive English study. And then we'll certainly get their first impressions.
Yeah, certainly. All of them are initially coming in to study English.
So they will not study anything but English?
Not at least for this first semester.
Mm.
And then as they progress to the point that their language is sufficient, they will begin taking their regular graduate classes.
Mm-hmm. So what do you see as the potential impact of this initiative and when we spin it out years into the future?
Well, I think for Iraq, it's going to bring into the country an educated population that has an understanding about the U.S., our values, our customs, and hopefully can take the good parts of it and use it into rebuilding their own country. I think for the United States in general, specifically for the University of Iowa, maybe this will help continue to dispel some of the images that we all have of the Middle East, the Arab world, and specifically Iraq.
Do you think our media, mainstream media, is giving us a fair representation of Iraq? You've been over there. You now have contact. You're building up more and more contacts with Iraqis. What are we not seeing enough of in the media when we see Iraq portrayed and the Iraqi people?
I think we see generalizations. You know, we look at the Iraq people, the Middle East people, the Muslim world as a unity and don't recognize the great diversity of individuals within it. Individuals who practice their religion in different ways. Individuals who have varying views of the world around them, of the United States, of our involvement there. You know, I think that happens with a lot of people. I just think we find it much easier to generalize about the Muslim world than we do many other parts of the world. And hopefully by meeting these individuals, it'll help dispel some of those wrong stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. How did the University of Iowa become involved? Because the University of Iowa is only is one of only how many?
Well, the initial group was 21 institutions. Mm-hmm. It has expanded some beyond that. We are involved quite heavily, though, because in the fall of 2008, we were one of the few schools accepted an invitation to go to Iraq for the announcement of the educational symposium. I was one of ended up 20 of us that actually traveled to the country in January of 2009. I would like to say we were the only Big Ten institution, and we're very proud of taking that leadership. But we went. We heard Prime Minister al-Maliki and others talk about the program, met with students, met with government and university officials. And so this group of schools has formed the core of the consortium that they work with, and others have been allowed in. But by our being there, we're still sort of favored institution status, mm-hmm. I guess.
Are there other institutions from Iowa represented in this group now? Or is
I would imagine the larger group there are. In the initial 21, though, we were the only Iowa institution.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that the University of Iowa would take this step because mm-hmm. It's not without risks. Or are there risks?
Well, yeah, it was with risk, obviously, going into Baghdad. I mean, I saw that from the first moment I stepped on the airplane because it was an unmarked plane that obviously was not your typical 737 jetliner. On that. But risks, I think, are a part of any development in higher education, any international development in higher education. We were there as guests of the Prime Minister. We had high security. And I think as an institution, we decided that the opportunities more than outweighed any potential risks that might come up.
Okay, we have to take a short break, and we'll be back to continue our conversation with Scott King, Assistant Dean of International Programs at the University of Iowa, to talk about this unique program, the program that welcomes Iraqi students, college students, to the United States and specifically to the University of Iowa, and they have arrived within the last few days. Let us know your thoughts, your concerns, your hopes as you hear about this program. In the next few minutes, call now 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, talking in this first half hour, talking about the first Iraqi students to be part of the education initiative, the Iraq Education Initiative across the United States, 80 having arrived in the United States within this past month. Four of them have arrived at the University of Iowa campus. We're talking with Scott King, Assistant Dean of International Programs at the University of Iowa, who is heading up this program. And for people, of course, when we listen to – we are still at war in Iraq. That mm-hmm. is long from over, even though we have decreased our troop levels there. There are a lot of security concerns in Iraq. What you have to be questioned constantly about the security concerns involved with inviting Iraqi students into this country. How do we know that there aren't a few bad apples in the bunch?
Well, the responsibility for that does really lie with the U.S. Embassy. I do know that these students have gone through security checks before they get their visas. That's actually been another one of the processes that have slowed things down. One of the checks that's done on anyone trying to get a visa to come to the United States to study, for example, is they look to see, does your name resemble someone who's on a known watch list? You know, sort of perhaps not too different from the do not fly list here in the United States. And many times students have a very common name, and that could come up against as an alert for the embassy. And then they have to go through the clearance procedure to make sure that this is not someone that is on their watch list that they would have to deny a visa to. Mm-hmm. And I know a good number of our students have been through that because, you know, many common names.
I wonder what the you've had contact with several of these students, mm-hmm. what their expectations are when they meet the people. How if they must be wondering, will I meet prejudice against me, or will I be viewed as a part of an endless war? Speak to that.
I haven't seen a lot of that. I think it's at least when they initially come, they're just so happy to be here that they don't think necessarily of any negative experiences that may be happening with them. I would imagine also to some extent probably most of these students have encountered Americans over there, some of our military troops, contractors and that. And these are people who by and large are viewed by the Iraqis as having helped them out of a difficult situation. So I think one of their first impressions will be these are other individuals from this same country that will help me as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are, of course, many, many United States veterans mm-hmm. of the Iraq War in the United States, in our institutions of higher learning, in Iowa's colleges and universities. And you have thought about how these people may be impacted by the visits and the stays of these Iraqi students. Yeah. What are you doing there?
Yeah. First, I think it's quite interesting. This is happening at the same time that the awareness of the veterans' needs on our campus has grown. That has been very much on everybody's mind now for the last couple of years. When I knew we were being involved in this program with the potential of bringing a good number of Iraqi students, one of the first things I did was contact the individuals on campus who work with veterans just to give them a heads up initially, saying, you know, I understand we have veterans that are still working through the issues of being in a war situation, and that seeing students coming in from Iraq, speaking the language, could possibly trigger memories they have not dealt with, trigger issues, just so that, and so worked with them so there was not a surprise on them. And the Veterans Affairs people on campus, the VA, are aware that we're working with this program. But what has come out of it is a hope that when the Iraqi students are comfortable with language, that we can use them in an educational fashion, pairing them with an Iraq war veteran who would be interested to talk about their shared experiences, their impressions of each other, how the troops viewed Iraq, how the Iraqis viewed the troops there. Just think it's a great educational opportunity to get beyond what we see in the news daily mm-hmm. and really see the people that the Iraq war is all about.
Where would these pairings of Iraqi mm-hmm. war veterans and Iraqi students be going to present?
Well, we already in international programs have a program where we send students out to K-12 schools to talk about cultural issues, you know, a Japanese student and a U.S. student who studied in Japan. And I see us using that network as well, hopefully doing just some general campus programming as well, having a forum, a discussion, a panel to discuss these issues.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I'm talking with Scott King. He is Assistant Dean of International Programs at the University of Iowa, talking about the Iraq Education Initiative at the University of Iowa. The University of Iowa, one of a number of institutions across the United States that are welcoming, as of the recent weeks, Iraqi students to study and to get to know Americans, and in this case, Iowans. What do you see as the other benefits for Iowa having these Iraqis here studying?
Well, getting to know Iowa as well. And again, as these people go back, as the students go back, return to Iraq, they're going to continue to have connections with Iowa. Maybe they become a small businessman looking for connections in the United States. This is the place they know. This is the place they may have already built connections with their classmates. So there can be long-term economic development as well for us on that. I do occasionally meet overseas alumni on my travels, and they fondly remember Iowa, want to find connections to retain that, you know, just like any alum does.
I understand that before the wars, Also the first Gulf War, the economic sanctions, the Iran-Iraq War. Iraq's education system decades ago was widely regarded as one of the very best in the region.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. At one point, they had over 90% literacy. They were spending amounts on education that were comparable to the United States. The percentage of their GNP was almost exactly what matched. You know, teachers were well paid. There was high literacy. There was about even equity between the genders in education. And the war cut the GNP into half. Teachers' salaries dropped. And especially in the rural areas, education and education of women also went into the background. Mm-hmm. So it suffered a lot due to the sanctions and the wars it's been involved
with. So these students, these young men and women who are coming to the United States, if they were left in Iraq, if they were in Iraq, and that will be building up over the decades to come, their prospects for higher education would have been?
They were limited, you know. And there are still very good universities in Iraq. As a matter of fact, they are part of the overall educational initiative. Another goal that the government has is to link Iraqi institutions with U.S. institutions to help the Iraqis develop. In many ways, they're 20, 30 years behind their counterparts in the rest of the world. So there's a lot of catching up to do. And you think in technological areas, every year it gets behind, the technological gap widens even more.
Mm-hmm. Now, we mentioned at the outset that this is not a program paid for by U.S. taxpayers in any way?
Not in any way. It is 100% funded by the Iraqi government.
Mm-hmm. But when we're pouring so much aid into Iraq, is that just another way of saying that we pour aid into Iraq and they pour a little bit of it back to our programs here?
Oh, you could get into the politics of that perhaps. I think that's something for the federal government to figure out, those flows. But the government is paying full out-of-state tuition for these students. They have living stipends. Those that are coming with families, and we have a lot coming with families, they will support their education in the United States as well. The spouses will be able to go to college to learn either a degree or English study if they want. So it's a lot of money.
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, for years after 9/11, the international students had a much harder time coming to the United States to study. Has that changed?
Oh, it's changed tremendously, yes. Right after 9/11, the government tightened up a lot on visas, regulations, but also at the same time set up a tracking system, something that had been looked at for many years but never set up for these long-term visitors. And as SEVIS, the tracking system, has grown and become more accurate, they've actually been able to have, I don't know if it's really more flexibility, but more consistency in visa regulations. Fewer students are turned down now. You know, the fact that there is a monitoring has helped the government put more balance, I think, into the whole visa process.
More security, less frustration for those who apply. And we want to ask you to stay around for after the break. Scott King, Assistant Dean of International Programs at the University of Iowa. Please do stay by, because when we come back, we want to change our focus to talk about students in Iowa who are from Pakistan. Imagine you are from Pakistan, you're here in Iowa, and there are the devastating floods in your homeland. We'll get a perspective on that from students from Pakistan when we return, and also field your calls and questions as we continue. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Welcome back to The Exchange on this sunny, pleasant afternoon across Iowa and the Midwest. I'm Ben Kiefer on Iowa Public Radio's news stream. In Pakistan today, hundreds of thousands fled floodwaters after the surging Indus River smashed through levees in two places. The new flooding came after the Taliban issued a veiled threat against foreign aid workers to help out in the crisis. Pakistan's worst floods in eight decades have claimed over 1,600 lives, affected more than 20 million people in that country. More than 8 million people in Pakistan are in need of emergency assistance across the country. The floods that began a month ago have damaged or destroyed more than a million homes. There are a number of Pakistani students studying in Iowa, and we wondered what it's like to be so far from your homeland when a catastrophe like this strikes. Joining me now, Ralph Arif. He's a University of Iowa graduate student in the School of Journalism. Ralph worked for years in Pakistan for local and Western media before coming to the United States as a Fulbright scholar. That was in 2007. He's now working on his PhD at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And he joins us in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Good afternoon to you, Ralph.
Good afternoon, Ben.
And we want to mention, too, that we did reach out to the Pakistani Student Association at Iowa State University hoping to have some of those students join our conversation. We didn't manage that today, so we'll be talking to Ralph. Scott King with us, Assistant Dean of International Programs, may lend us a few words in this conversation as well. And we want to reach out to our listeners to join our conversation. Have you ever been overseas at a time of great turmoil in your home? What was it like? How did you cope? 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. First of all, Ralph Arif, we want to ask about your friends and family. How are the people in your friends and in your circle of friends and your family now?
Yeah, Ben, luckily my family is safe so far, but I just want to tell you, like, where my parents live, they are living next to the Indus River. They are in 20-mile radius of Indus River. They are getting those warnings every day, like, evacuate the place. So far, they are safe, so that's a good news. But at the same time, the bad news is it's very stressing for me. Every day I have to talk to them. Like, are you safe? How about the flood situation? Because areas around them in 20-mile radius, they have already been destroyed. It's the view looks like an inland sea kind of thing, where you don't see any more homes, cattle, people. It's water all around everybody. So,
and where are the people that inhabited those areas now?
Yeah, most of them are located on the border of Sindh and Punjab province. I just want to give a background how this flood started. When monsoon rain season started, it started occurring from north side of Pakistan, and those monsoon water caused flooding in the rivers. They expand in the south area of Pakistan. My parents live in the south of Pakistan, and now like after the causing havoc and destruction in the northern areas, now flood is affecting all those areas. They come in Sindh province or south side of Pakistan.
It's hard to imagine the magnitude affecting more than 20 million people. Pakistan is a country of how many people? 100 and
That's 180 million people.
So that's almost a little less, 1 in 10, 1 in 15 people affected by this flooding.
Exactly, yeah. If I just give you brief statistics, you already mentioned few of them, like 5 million people now so far, as of today, are homeless now. They don't have any shelter. They have to sleep under this sky, I mean open sky. They don't have any food. They don't have water. 36,000 people, they are suffering from diseases such as diarrhea, and cases of epidemics such as cholera, they have been reported in them. I just want to add, Ben, another important thing, which probably most of the international media is missing, is the frustration among those people who are homeless, who don't have food, that actually is being diverted towards women and children. Women and children in my country, which is like, you know, pretty much male-dominated country, are the most, you know, insecure communities. Whatever happens, any kind of disaster comes in Pakistan that actually or eventually affects women and children. I will quote the example when I was working as a journalist in Pakistan in 2005 after the devastating earthquake. Like, many reports of violence against women, they increased. Their husbands, they started beating their children as well, because this frustration eventually triggered down to them. So we don't only have to think about what is causing because of flooding, but at the same time, what is happening to those communities and how to save them. It's a big challenge, or it's a rather bigger challenge than we are thinking now.
According to the information that I have up to this point in this month-long disaster, United States flood relief assistance to Pakistan is now reached $200 million to date. The U.S. has shipped almost 2 million pounds of relief supplies to the people of Pakistan. What are your contacts with Pakistan saying about your family, friends, circle of friends, the anecdotal evidence that you got? Are there any comments about the relief coming from the United States or the rest of the world? Is it making a difference? Is it making an impact? Is it being appreciated?
Oh, definitely. It's making a big difference, let me tell you. And that's part of the reason, I will say, like, that's frustrating those Taliban people or extremist factions in the society, because people, common people in Pakistan, they are very much responsive. They are very thankful to international aid. And all those Western aid's effort in Pakistan, basically, this is kind of a wonderful way to build the close relations between the common man of Pakistan. And that's how Taliban are frustrated over there. That's how that we are hearing the news of, like, that Taliban are threatening to the foreign aid workers. I'm very concerned about that, because we don't have to lose the opportunity. At the same time, millions of people are in hour of need. We don't have to stop this aid work and this wonderful work over there just for a few threats. We have to be careful at the same time, but we have to keep doing our work. Otherwise, it can be a bigger disaster than anywhere in the country. Maybe tsunami would be a lesser disaster if we cannot control the starvation and epidemic over there.
And Ralph Arif, please tell me again, because I'm not sure I got the point with the problem you saw connected with this aid in regards to women and children. This aid, this relief from the United States, comes there and is diverted away from children and women, because it is, in some parts of the country, a very male-dominated culture. That's what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah. So we have to think in this way. First, whenever we want to reach to those affected people, we don't have road infrastructure anymore. We don't have bridges. They connect like one area of the of a city to the other area, because you have a huge rivers between them and water, right? So you can only use helicopters, right? When you use helicopters, you have to throw the aid, and like there are male people who will fight with each other. They will snatch food, and like children and women, they are the ones who are weak factions of the society. The aid is not reaching them properly. That's a big issue. At the same time, like at some points, UN also admitted, like, because of the increasing frustration, when we are reaching there, it's either late or it's not effective way, because we lost all the energy and communication system over there. Railroad infrastructure has been damaged. I told you, all the big bridges have been washed away. So it's a bigger concern. So we have to keep in mind, when we are doing our relief efforts, we have to make sure or devise a plan that we have an outreach to the women and children as well. Otherwise, it will be a very difficult situation in the days to come.
Ralph Arif, if you've just joined us, my guest for this half hour, Ralph Arif, a University of Iowa graduate school student in the School of Journalism. He comes from Pakistan, a Fulbright scholar. And if you have any questions about what's going on in Pakistan, the relief efforts there, the continued catastrophic flooding happening there, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Our email, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Scott King from our first half hour still with us, the Assistant Dean of International Programs at the University of Iowa. One would naturally think, Scott, that the international programs at a major university would have some connections, or more generally, how do you react with all the connections that a international programs has at the University of Iowa when a calamity happens abroad?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of our focus is on the individuals who've been impacted by it. As far as students, there are generally two groups we have to be concerned with. The first, of course, would be any of our current students who happen to be studying abroad, doing research abroad. Their study abroad unit in international programs has the protocols to get in touch with these students, make sure they're safe. If there is a need, evacuate them, get all the resources, and obviously communicate with their families. You know, we have connections where we can usually get through to a student who's overseas, even if their family cannot. The area that I work with closely, the students that come here from overseas, we do a lot of personal support for the students at that time, help them find the resources they may need to connect with their families. Mm-hmm. Even though students are very, very inventive in finding out. But, you know, when helping them work with the stress sometimes of not knowing or just frustration of not being able to solve anything.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Scott, because that's where I wanted to turn back to Ralph with about the personal experience, the stress of being here. Give us some personal reflections about what it's like when your homeland is in such distress. So many people in your homeland, though thankfully also not your family, your immediate family is left out of it right now, still very close to the Indus River right now. Being here must be an incredible feeling of helplessness for you and your wife.
Right. Ben, there's something which me and my wife, both are students in the University of Iowa, we are dealing with. Our semester started, we have our pressure of our studies, and we have to turn in our assignments in time. You know, we have other things to accomplish at the same time. Our half of our mind is always thinking back towards the safety of our parents, our friends and family. So it's really very, you know, kind of like stressful time I'm going through right now, and my wife is going through. I have to spend more money now to call every day back at my home country. I mean, talk to them for a longer period of time. It's not always easy or inexpensive to call back in your home country.
Is there anything you can practically do from this distance? Probably not much.
Yeah, not much. Just we are trying to reach out with other Pakistani students in the University of Iowa or in Iowa State University. And we are trying to collect clothes or anything, any other kind of aid so that we can send back to our home country. So we are like trying to organize our meetings almost once a week, and we are trying to convince people like each dollar counts. I mean, if we can save one life against $1, mm-hmm. that will be a big service for humanity.
There are some press reports about the reaction to the catastrophe in Haiti compared to the one now in Pakistan, and perhaps the reaction in terms of relief and help, giving, donations, not being what it was, even though the Pakistani catastrophe is equal, even much more in terms of human consequences. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, first thing is, Ben, I think people did not grasp the gravity of the situation over there in the beginning, and that's why the response to UN appeal was really very, very slow. And that's why, like, we could not reach the people well in time. We could not save those lives who were already there, and when the water reached them, it was already too late. They did not have even boats, the basic boats, those could save those lives. So that was delayed. But now good news is, since now international community has started realizing, and they have started pledging either or started putting more and more money in terms of donations, medicine, food, water, whatever they can, they have started providing them. But now, since we don't have infrastructure over there, this is very important thing. How to reach them? That's becoming a bigger issue. When you don't have any kind of road infrastructure or something, you can either use helicopters only, but how you will use them when there is heavy torrential rainfall, you cannot fly those helicopters, right? So people are dying because of hunger. And this month was supposed to be a holy month in Pakistan because of Ramadan. People celebrate this month in a very respectable way, where they fast and they arrange special kind of, like, you know, food gatherings in the evenings when they break their fast. And then there will be a big event just like Christmas in Pakistan that is called as Eid. Like it's the to celebrate the end of Ramadan. I don't see they will be having any opportunity to celebrate these kind of occasion. At the same time, I don't feel like enjoying any of these things because of the stress on me every time. Like mm-hmm. I would say, like, my mind is always pregnant with the thoughts of my family and friends and their safety all the time with me.
We certainly hear a lot about Ramadan, but a lot of people don't actually know what it is a celebration of. Remind us of that.
It's in Muslim tradition, it's known as the holy month of Ramadan, in which you fast from dawn to dusk, and you pray for the safety and security of humanity. In other words, it is known as the month of peace, like, in which you give the message of peace. When you fast, basically, it means you are trying to recall the hunger and miseries of other people, like how would they feel if they don't have food to eat. So it's kind of like, you know, trying to connect people who are in need. And then eventually we celebrate our event, that's the end of Ramadan, we call it Eid.
Ralph Arif is with us, a University of Iowa graduate student from Pakistan. Ralph worked for years in Pakistan for local and Western media, and he's here with us today to give us some background, some personal reflections on the catastrophic situation with the flooding, the floods that have gone on practically a month now in Pakistan. Great loss of life, 1,600 people confirmed dead, a million homes destroyed, 20 million people in a country of 180 million affected by this flood. If that was Iowa, it would be sort of 1 in 10 or 1 in 50. It would be many thousands, many tens of thousands of Iowans if we were to compare it to Iowa. I want to tap into your thoughts as a journalist here. You have worked in Pakistani media over there. Mm-hmm. You have worked for Western media over there, I believe, for the BBC. Also for
CNBC. Yep.
CNBC. And when you look at our media coverage of what's going on in Pakistan, are you seeing some things that we aren't? Besides, you mentioned the aid that's not getting covered and the problems reaching children and women.
Right. Unfortunately, after 9/11, what is happening on in terms of like news coverage all over the world is terrorism news always take first part, whatever the issue is. Right. Whenever anything that's associated with terrorism, we start talking about terrorism internationally, and we forget what the real issue is. For example, when Taliban threatened this aid work. Now, this news of flooding situation is becoming less important, and the threat is becoming more important, right? So what happens? People actually lose their focus to what is happening to 20 million people over there, right? So that's something
So you're saying that the mainstream U.S. media is over-dramatizing the threat of the Taliban to relief workers?
I wouldn't say over-dramatizing. It's not only U.S. media. It has been a trend, like... all those September 11 attacks, and since afterwards, after the aftermath of September 11 attacks, that has changed the journalism practices all over the world. So what is missing now? We have we don't have in-depth approach. We are not going to see the case studies over there, for example. What is happening to friends and families over there? Nobody is talking about the cattle. You know, cattle is very important. Pakistan is not an industrial country, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, their livelihood are all about cattle. If their cattle die, they don't have food, they don't have meat, they don't have milk, right? Their cattle died, right? 7.9 million acre farmland so far has been destroyed. So they have nothing. I mean, we have to dig deeper. We have to explore these issues. And as I said, we have to give coverage to the women and children over there. They make half of the population in Pakistan, and they are the ones who are under immense, you know, pressure in terms of so many reasons, and they are like most vulnerable community of the society. So I would like to see this kind of news stories more and more so that international community try to grasp the gravity of the situation.
Mm-hmm. And talk again, you mentioned this earlier, but a little bit more in depth about the opportunity. I think you called it an opportunity for the U.S. to connect with the common people, many common people in Pakistan, and how that would be important in the regional conflict going on there across the border with Afghanistan. Why is the connection right now in terms of relief aid important?
Right. We have during my last program with you when you interviewed me about the situation of Afghanistan and Pakistan, we talked about the drone attacks and drone diplomacy and other kind of things. People, basically, common men of Pakistan, they never thought this war against terrorism basically is, or US forces or NATO forces are there to help them out. They always thought as some kind of, you know, a pressure on them or oppression on them, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a wonderful opportunity that when US reaches out over there with aid or other kind of humanitarian activities, it will give a strong message to the common man of Pakistan. Look, United States care about the common man of Pakistan. It's not all about the war against terrorism or Afghanistan or Pakistan on the bordering areas. So I think this is a wonderful opportunity. And I remember, I will quote the example, when Chinook helicopters, when they landed for the very first time in 2005, not to fight against culprits, rather to help those people who were affected because of the earthquakes. people welcomed them. I remember, like, they labeled those Chinook helicopters as the angel of mercies, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, angels of mercy. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to see again those kind of, like, feelings between United States and common man of U.S. and common man of Pakistan. And it will overcome all those misconceptions those exist between these two countries.
And Scott King, before we end our program, what are your reflections as you hear this very articulate man here visiting our program, you know, our country, our state here, and you hear him talk about this?
Well, I just think it's another blessing of the types of students we have here at the University of Iowa and just how these students make world events real to the everyday life of all of us and show how we're so intertwined in today's world.
Mm-hmm. And so the growth of international programs at the University of Iowa, other universities, has been tremendous in recent years. What's driving that growth?
It's growing interest, growing economies in some of the developing world, growing interest in getting the benefits of U.S. higher education, and the increasing knowledge that this is still the gold standard for university studies in the world.
Okay, Scott King, thank you for staying with us for the entire hour. Assistant Dean of International Programs at the University of Iowa. A big thanks to Ralph Arif for coming again to The Exchange to share your thoughts.
Thanks.
Give us some background as we have our thoughts with the people of Pakistan during these catastrophic floods, and hopefully the end of the floods will come soon. Thank you, Ralph Arif, graduate student from Pakistan at the University of Iowa. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins, and we had help today from Dennis Reese as well. And The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.